domicile, the global destruction of home. Homes, places that are a quiet refuge from the outside world. The deliberate destruction of home is called domicile. Home, having a home, having a place to live, having shelter, is a basic human right according to the UN. The result is a loss of security and ownership, restrictions on freedom, partial loss of identity, loss of historical connection, and changes the lives of a considerable number of people. Today's show, we still look at unions from the point of view of activism. We attended a training course held in Hamilton.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is identification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
So the first, I think, thing that I want to say as an activist in the union, I want to take the words that a sister said, because I think that her words really explain, you know, why we become active in the trade union movement or why we become active in community or anti-poverty organizations. And it's essentially, as she said, because we believe in equality, fairness, and because we're fighters. We're fighters for social justice on different fronts. Now, in terms of QP Ontario, at our last convention, QP Ontario has about 250,000 workers, represents about 250,000 workers across the province in the healthcare sector, municipal city workers, the school boards, at the university level, both teaching assistants, so both academic and non-academic positions, as well as people that work in social services agencies or community services agencies. The brother mentioned, I think, the Good Shepherd Women's Center, so social services, community services agencies. Many of those are also represented by QP. And every year, QP has a big conference or convention where representatives from the locals come to it. I mean, some of the QP members here were probably at last year's convention. And that's where we discuss and debate issues that are relevant to the work that we're doing at the union. And last year, a resolution, an emergency resolution, was put to the floor at the QP Ontario convention, responding to the fact that the McGuinty government, a few months before, in March of 2010, had announced that the special diet benefit was going to be cut. So this kind of galvanized and mobilized, and there was a lot of organizing that happened in the community, not necessarily in QP, but with QP support. So this resolution came to the floor. It was debated, and it was endorsed by the majority of the membership, and now it's become policy in QP Ontario. And what we're doing and the purpose for this meeting, and we're having other meetings like this in different cities and areas of the province, is to implement this resolution and to organize around this issue. So this emergency resolution calls on QP to endorse and actively support campaigns to raise social assistance rates to the pre-Harris cut levels. And Lisa is going to get into that whole context, which I know many of you are also aware of. Also, to develop and implement an education campaign on social assistance for QP Ontario locals alongside the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, including developing materials and doing train-the-trainer sessions, and also to provide financial support with sustaining this organizing around the Raise the Rates campaign, and also to do educational sessions at various QP Ontario conferences and QP schools. So what we've been doing is, since about January and February of this year, we've been going out to, you know, the QP schools that happen every couple of months. There's also different conferences that are happening right now in QP for the different sectors, for the municipal sector, for the university workers. And what we've been doing is we've been doing sessions like this, myself, other QP activists, along with Lisa, someone mentioned John Clark from OCAP, as well, and other OCAP activists. And the purpose of the session essentially is to contextualize for our members and for the other activists that are here why fighting for increasing social assistance rates is an important fight both for anti-poverty organizations like OCAP, but why it's also an important fight or struggle for us as members of the trade union. So one of the things that we did, we also, in our work, we've developed this kind of booklet to explain why this is a QP issue, and we've printed this in French and in English, and it's been distributed at all the events, QP events and community events that we go to. We've been distributing it. So maybe I'll just, maybe you can pass it around and hopefully we have enough for everybody. So you get an idea of some of the materials that we're distributing. I think beyond the resolution, the organizing or political spirit behind this work is to do exactly what we've done tonight, to be able to bring together trade union activists and anti-poverty activists for us to begin discussing how we can organize together to increase the fight back, if we can call it that, the fight back to increase social assistance rates. How can we effectively pressure the McGuinty government or whatever new government comes into power provincially to effectively increase the social assistance rates, at least to the levels of where they were at when they were cut in the mid-90s under Harris, and also to fight to fully restore the special diet benefit, which we're going to talk about, and many of you know either from direct experience or from your work. We're also facing a lot of attacks, as many of you know, as trade unionists, downward pressures on our wages. There's also a push for a wage freeze in Ontario against QP members and the broader public sector. So it's also to discuss how we can struggle together on these different fronts, because if you're fighting for increased social assistance rates, full restoration of the special diet, we feel that if we can make gains on that front, we'll also make gains more generally as trade unionists, and hopefully the people that are not in a trade union will also be in solidarity with us in all the battles and all the struggles that we have. And the other aim is also, I think someone just said, it's to have union members here. And we think for a long, long time, I think in Ontario and in other parts of Canada, the unions and the community activists are not always working together, for various reasons. I mean, I think the powers that be want to keep us separate. So I think one of the main achievements of this campaign is to be able to do this, to sit together, community activists, anti-poverty activists, people that are in the union, that are currently in the union, that were in the union before, that maybe lost their jobs, no longer in the union, so that we can strategize together. So that's why we're here, at least from our perspective. And now I think Lisa will talk about the context, which is really, really important, because this fight didn't begin this year or a few months ago at our convention.
Okay, so thank you so much for having us in Hamilton. I've been coming back and forth and for a while now as OCAP organizer and meeting with the campaign, and it's nice to come together with QP activists as well today, so thank you so much for having us. I love Hamilton. I think it's a great city. I always love visiting. It's great to be back. So I was just going to go into the history of why are the rates as low as they are? What made it so that the conditions are so bad today? And I know a lot of this information is not going to be new to people, but the real point of these train the trainer sessions, of these workshops, is to give people the tools and the facts to go out and argue those facts and be able to be supporting the campaign publicly. So we're going to be doing a couple of those things today, where we're going to be going through the facts and the history, so we're all refreshed about the history and what the facts are on the ground. And then we're going to be doing small group breakouts, where we're each going to be going through, we're going to break into three different groups, and each of those groups is going to take a different myth that we're constantly hearing about social assistance in the news or sometimes in our own communities, and breaking those down. And how do we argue these myths? How do we argue against them? How do we use the facts that we've all come to know and argue those myths to join a fight to raise the rates? So just my own experience, why I do this work, why I came to be doing this, is that I'm what they call a creation of the Harris government. So I grew up on social assistance rates in the province, on social assistance in the province of Ontario, on welfare. My mom was on welfare, a single mom, then on ODSP. and I was a teenager when the Harris government cut welfare by 21.6% in 1995, and that was a total upheaval in my life and a total upheaval in my mom's life. We lost our housing at that time. We're forced into, you know, moving constantly into the shelter system, that sort of thing. So I would say that that was the point in my life when I was politicized. I was, something was going on, and something was larger than my family. Something was larger than just my mom and what we were and weren't able to do to make ends meet. And one of those myths that poor people are constantly told in your life is that it's your fault, right? You didn't work hard enough. You didn't get the right education. You just have to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, work a little harder. You could do it, right? So you internalize that. If you grow up in that, you internalize that. And so I remember those years against Harris as being crucial in breaking that for me in that internalization. So, and really seeing the way that unions and community organizations were coming together to fight the Harris government. And I became a part of that as a teenager and joined OCAP not that far after that. So that's how I came to start doing this work. And it's very, very close to my heart and perhaps a bit of a personal vendetta as well attached to it, but never know. It's useful. So I'm going to go through the history. Why is the situation as grim as it is right now? And then we'll get into the hopeful stuff after that. So as I said, in 1995, the Harris government, the Tory government in Ontario, slashed welfare by 21.6% and froze disability rates. And, you know, prior to this, it wasn't like people were living the high life on welfare. It was certainly still a poverty amount, but Harris came in as part of the Common Sense Revolution, slashed welfare by 21.6% and froze disability rates. And as folks would remember, at the same time, we sort of saw a shift in the way that people on assistance were being categorized and talked about. There was a lot of this language of the bums, the cheats, the scammers, the drunks, whatever terrible thing you want to say. That was being said in the mainstream media and by Harris and his government himself, right? There was an increase in the criminalization of people on assistance, arresting people for supposed fraud, trying to enforce a fingerprinting system, a workfare system, which is basically indentured labor. People might remember the case of a woman by the name of Kimberly Rogers in Sudbury, Ontario. She was forced to be under house arrest after being accused of welfare fraud, and she sadly and really unfortunately died alone in her apartment. While under house arrest, and she was 8 months pregnant. And the Harris years, I think we can all recognize in this room, there's no doubt that they were brutal for poor people in the province of Ontario and for working people. I'm talking about social assistance rates, but on top of that, there was a gutting of public services. There was a gutting of the support networks for people, for poor and working people across the province. And it really changed how I think services are administered to more of a business and moving towards a privatization model in the province. So jump ahead to 2003. In 2003, the Liberals were elected on a promise of reversing the Harris cuts and increasing public spending. The Liberals also began their sort of language and rhetoric around poverty reduction. So we've seen a lot of, from the Liberal end, creating of councils and professional committees to comment on what we already know is a very serious crisis of poverty in the province. They raised OW and ODSP amounts by very minuscule amounts. So you saw 2% 1 year, 1% another year. But what I think a lot of people don't realize is that 2% and that 1% doesn't actually even account for inflation within 1 year for most years. Like this past year, they didn't even actually raise it by the rate of inflation for the year. So actually people are taking a cut. So today, with inflation and the cost of living increases over the last 15 years, on top of that already existing 21.6% cut in 1995, welfare rates are approximately 55% below where they should be. 55%. So a single person on welfare right now is receiving how much is a single, anybody want to throw out a guess?
$560 for one single family?
For a single person on welfare.
The maximum is $592, but many get less than that. Island get 549.
So yeah, it's approximately 590 is the base amount. Some people do get less depending on where you're living. If you're living in subsidized housing or whatever, they might reduce the amounts. But a single person on welfare, $590-ish dollars a month. That amount would need to be immediately raised to $904 a month to be equivalent to the spending power we had in 1994. So you can see that disparity. The McGuinty Liberals have talked a lot about poverty reduction, and there's been a lot of empty promises coming from them. But the fact of the matter is that poor people in Ontario are worse off today than they were under Harris when you take that inflation over the last 16 years. And they failed to do the one thing that they needed to do, which was to reverse the Harris cuts. And they've, in fact, perpetuated a further decline in people's income levels. So I just wanted to refer to the handout here as something that people can use. So this chart is on the back of the pamphlet, is about a year old, so the rates on this are a little bit outdated, but it's sort of the averages. But you can see already the base amount that a person gets on welfare is about $590 a month. The average cost of a bachelor apartment, this is for the city of Toronto. I'm not sure what the average cost of a bachelor apartment is for Hamilton, but I imagine it's not that much cheaper. Is about $777 a month is the new quote I just looked up the other day. So you're already, you know, $200 minus what you would need to have a place to live. And then the average cost of a healthy food basket, nutritional food basket, they estimated in the city of Toronto for a single person is about $205 a month. So that would be actual real vegetables, fruit, nutritional food. That would cost a single person about $205 a month. So this is just a single person. When you take in, that's not even taking into account a family, if you have children and people that are dependent. So it's in this context of the rates being so brutally low and so inadequate that people have been forced into this situation of scrambling to try and find whatever means they can to raise their income. So this is where the special diet allowance came into effect and where it became so important for people. It is some basic relief for people from the daily and monthly battle on assistance to try and make ends meet. It allows for healthy food to be a potential. The history of the special diet is that it used to be up to $250 per person if you could get a medical practitioner, like a doctor or a nurse or a midwife, to sign a medical form saying that you need this special diet. And it's since come into all these sort of different stages. The special diet was then sort of attacked, and it was no longer associated with a... It used to be that you could get it for an organic diet. You would be prescribed, essentially, an organic diet. You're being prescribed food by a doctor. The government came in, they changed it. Now it's associated with medical conditions. So it's, you know, $10 for this, $11 for that. A lot of medical conditions are missing from the list. The amounts associated with them are somewhat arbitrary. We're not sure where that came from. But in 2005, OCAP began what we called the Raise the Rates campaign. And, you know, we've always had the demand, obviously, when we were fighting the Harris government, the demand to raise welfare and disability rates was certainly front and center. But we launched in 2005 against the Liberal government the Raise the Rates campaign to demand that the Liberals restore or reverse the Harris cuts and restore the social assistance rates and to match inflation to today. Which, when you break that down, is really not a radical idea. If you break down, you know, we're asking for a basic amount. And we came across this special diet because we, you know, a lot of our members are on assistance, started to recognize this special diet as something that people could use, that could access. And so we began to mass publicize it along with the Health Providers Against Poverty. And I think this is where it becomes key, because a lot of the things you hear about the special diet and the people who started to access the special diet is fraud, right? There's this thing that comes back from the government, and we've heard it again, and I, you know, that's why I said that part about Harris and that being a center part of his argument, is that the government, Liberal government, came back and said, well, the people trying to get the special diet, they're committing fraud. They're lying. They don't have these conditions, whatever, whatever, right? But what I saw in those clinics that were being held is thousands of people desperately trying to gain some basic income to buy healthy food. And what I saw is thousands of people lined up, desperately looking for a doctor, driving for hours and hours to find a doctor who would fill out these forms just to try and raise the income they were getting every month so they could put food on the table for their families. And that was the reality. If you're going to force people to live in such extreme poverty, you better expect that if they find a benefit that they can try and get some food with, that they're going to go after it. And people have every right to do that. So, yeah.
You're speaking, and it's so bothersome. My soul is bothered right now. And I'm sitting here thinking, of course it's easy for them to say that that's fraud. We're committing fraud by lining up and trying to get a doctor's note. What's really fraudulent is the fact that the government is keeping it from us and not letting us know that these benefits are available. So you were saying earlier, my sister over here, that the basic allowance for one person is $509 approximately. I have a family member that lives in Hamilton, Ontario, and she has one child, and she literally gets $560, and that's why I quoted that earlier. That is less than what, that's disgusting. There's no way that she can survive, and people constantly have to give her money. She can't get a job. It's, maybe she doesn't have the proper education, but that's not the point. It's a good, we live in Canada, we should be getting what we're entitled to from the government. We're not part of the states, so really, that's fraud. Yeah. So I just needed to say that. So.
No, totally. I 100% agree with you, and that's, I think, exactly how we need to spin the argument around, right? It's like, who is harming who here, right? And if we're going to start criminalizing poor people in that way, then I want to refer back to the case of Kimberly Rogers, right? You're forcing a single woman to be under house arrest for trying to, you know, increase her income when you forced her to be in that position. That's the real criminality there, right?
Can I add to that that she, yeah, the reason she got charged is because she got a student's loan. Real simple trap. She got a student's loan while she was on welfare, so that she could educate herself. She was the best in her class. She was just finishing her course. She was trying to better herself and get a job. And that's what the Harris government decided was fraud. And they gave her house arrest in Sudbury in the summer, and she died from either suicide or the heat, one or the other.
Yeah. I'll just finish up with the background here to the rates, and then I'm going to pass it on to the others. But I just wanted to add that the health providers who got involved in the campaign really got involved from this understanding that if people cannot afford healthy food, that they're going to get sick, and that the biggest determinant of poor health is poverty, and so they got involved from that perspective and are still involved today and are speaking at our assembly on Saturday, and the special diet gained popularity really fast, as I said, and then the government tried in multiple ways to change it and limit access to it time and time again, but still people were coming out in huge numbers to try and gain access to it. Until finally last year, as Ilium has already said, the McGuinty government came in, and as part of their, you know, we have to make cuts, we're in an economic crisis, what are we to do? They announced that they're going to be completely cutting the special diet. And they failed to raise, at the same time that they announced they're going to cut the special diet, they failed to raise the rates by any significant amount. They announced a 2% raise, which, again, doesn't account for inflation for 1 year. So that overall, what we would be losing in the social assistance system is 3% across the board. At the same time, they announced a $4.6 billion tax break over the next 3 years to corporations. So communities were outraged by this announcement by the McGuinty government. We mobilized. Hamilton mobilized. And the government has since sort of backtracked in this way, but in a very liberal way, in a very Liberal Party way. They've basically are still implementing a cut without calling it a cut. So this new special diet program that they're bringing into place starts on April 1st, which is why later I'm going to talk about the demonstration on April 1st and why it's on April 1st. But the new program they're bringing into place on April 1st is missing a lot of the previously listed conditions that people used to be able to get money through. A lot of the amounts have been reduced, and now people are going to be forced to sign a medical release form on the actual application, which is a huge invasion of privacy for people on assistance. And in their own statement, the Liberal government has said that most people will not be eligible. The City of Toronto, we're facing a Ford. People know who Rob Ford is, right? Infamous Rob Ford. So in the City of Toronto, Rob Ford has already said that they're going to be saving $10 million because of the provincial government's changes to the special diet. So on all levels, the governments are saying that this is a move to, quote, respect taxpayers. And the Liberal government this year, provincial government this year, is bringing down their provincial budget on March 29th, just before our day of action. So we're looking very closely to see what it is that they're going to be announcing this year. The potential of further cuts is certainly real, and we're going to be looking very closely about what's coming next. So that's just a little bit of background about where the rates are at and why they're as low as they are. And I'm going to pass it over to, I think, Michelle.
Okay. My name is Michelle. I'm a longtime member of the CAWDB, Campaign for Welfare and Disability Benefits. This is a local group that's been around since 2003. We're a grassroots group made up mostly of low-income people. We've done numerous events through the years. We've held all candidate debates for municipal and provincial elections. We held a forum on poverty and health. And one of the most interesting facts that I had learned from that forum was there's a group of Hamilton doctors, healthcare providers against poverty. And for every doctor that fills out a form for special diet, is actually treated like it's like the Gestapo's coming in. All the doctor's records are checked and so on and so forth. So it's really puts pressure on healthcare providers who may be disinterested. How she put it was, when a doctor goes through schooling, medical training, they don't necessarily learn healthcare and poverty. This particular doctor, like, she learned through the years. She worked in the north end of Hamilton, and she was quite frustrated dealing with many of her patients, trying to get them on the special diet and or whatever she could. So through the years, she had learned. But it's really a warning to anyone who works in the medical field that they need to start joining together as well. Also, we've also done focus groups on food security issues. So we did a survey. We actually surveyed food bank users in the Hamilton area. And the most alarming fact that we come out of that was that people are afraid to complain about the bad and rotten food they're getting from the food banks. So we did that in 2008. We made a presentation in front of the Board of Health Committee, which is a city council committee. We also stressed the need for inspections, because it doesn't seem that there's any kind of inspection and so on. So no fresh vegetables. It's just appalling, really, because a lot of the food is, it's processed, high in sugar, salt, fat. You get very little fresh fruits or vegetables. Since we've come on the scene, they've made some little, in the fall, they may get some kind of fresh fruits from local farmers, but really it's kind of like a free-for-all, so you may get a bin and people are just diving in. It's sometimes hard that way. But despite all that, we at the campaign feel that it really comes down to organizing. And that's organizing at the grassroots level. And that means getting people involved, empowering them. A lot of people don't really understand. The messaging that comes from mainstream media is absolutely ridiculous. The demonizing and criminalizing of the poor is atrocious. And it's really unfortunate that too many people spend too much, they're too busy to actually research and find out the information and listen to 10-second sound bites and think that that's reality. So I'm really happy that, anybody who's here from organized labor, that you can take this information and spread it among your membership, and so they really truly understand what's going on out there. Last year, like low-income people tend not to vote, so that's a problem too. So you know, how can they have a voice if they're not voting? But a lot of them feel like just kind of over here, my voice doesn't count, so why should I vote? So that's a problem too. Last fall, we did a rally and we did a petition, which we took to.
Can I go back to that comment? I worked the elections and I worked in an area where there was a lot of low income people and a lot of mixed income levels, and you could see the disdain for, oh, who just walked in. It's unfortunate because, I mean, they have the right to vote. I mean, they have the same, we all have the same voice, and it was appalling to see that. Oh, well, I have a job, or I have whatever it is, and you know, it was appalling to see that.
Mm-hmm. How did they know they were poor?
Yeah, when you said that just got me right to that.
How did they know that they were poor?
Well, you could see the people who come in their, you know, fancy clothes that pulled up in the Lexus, and the people who weren't dressed the same. It was kind of us and them. You could see the people coming in, and you could, you know, it was unbelievable. You couldn't miss it. It was blatant. So, yeah, when you said that, that totally triggered that.
Yeah, well, you know, but, you know.
It's unfortunate because, I mean, they have the right. We all have the right. We need to get them out there. We need everyone to vote.
But, you know, it's like I went to a course, like, a couple weeks ago, and someone who was a union member, you know, and because I was the only one that was kind of grassroots. I don't belong to a union. And, you know, they said, well, I work for a living, and I'm sitting there because I'm unemployed. Right now, but I've always worked for a living too, and you know, it kind of bothered me, like, you know what I mean, in a sense that,
yeah, it was that kind of attitude that,
yeah,
you know, I earned this though, kind of thing. It was appalling, and
yeah,
you know, I it really took you saying that for me to see that.
So last year we did a petition, basically calling for the same raise the rates. We got about 2,000 signatures. With the help of Paul Miller's office, we got it introduced into the legislature. What was interesting is, like, petitions going daily at Queen's Park, they're usually one or two pages, and ours was like this thick. So from a visual impact from people sitting there, it did look quite thick, but in reality, like, there's 500,000 people in Hamilton, so 2,000 signatures isn't really going to make a huge impact. But we did our best. I also found, in sitting there in the legislature, I thought it was like a show, okay? Like, you know, it's just rhetoric back and forth. You know, they ask questions, but they don't really answer them, and we wonder why nothing ever gets done. So, like, you know, we all need to join together. Doesn't matter who we are. Instead of, you know, they should define us all as the working class. So the working class encompasses all workers, like all people, like, instead of, you know, oh, the low income group or the middle class, we're all the working class. So to have that ability to join together and truly understand what's going on out there, because a lot of people don't know the welfare system, and truly, like, I know there's many people out there who, you know, it could be a husband and wife and they both work, and like they're one paycheck from disaster and they have no clue. If they lost their job, what would happen to them? You know, because they think that we get free housing and free dental and free this and free that, and you don't. And whatever you try to get, you have to fight and jump hoops to get. So it's important. So for most of us at the campaign, many of them are on OESPs, so they're a little bit better off. But the ones on OW, it's absolutely, you can't survive. You're lucky if you can cover shelter costs, never mind food, and then you have to go to the food banks, and you really only get food for a couple days.
That's right.
You don't get food for a whole month. So that's an issue right there that people have to understand that. I know that there's lots of messaging out there that, like, all these kind of not-for-profit groups are really helping the poor, but they're really not. And it needs to be addressed. Yes?
Can I ask you a question? You said their food only lasts a couple of days. Are they able to go back to the food bank?
No.
3 days a month.
Whenever they get there?
Some are once a month, some are once every 3 months, and some are once every 6 months.
Wow.
And we have found that those on ODSP, are tended to be, they really give people on ODSP a hard time.
Wow.
Right, because you have to do what they call means testing. So they'll go through, you have to have a rent statement and provide your hydro bill, your telephone bill, and, you know, you got someone over here, you know, who's deciding. So we have we had a local blog, the Poverty Project, and I was blogging on there all the time. And I know this was one worker who works at one of the local food banks, and because they knew that I was a member of the campaign, and they got on there and said, saying that we as citizens and community groups should not be getting in front of city council and making presentations because we're all on the same side. And I blogged back saying, well, who the hell do you think you really are, right? Because it's just ridiculous, right? So there you go. But there's also, like, lots of other things. So let's look at workfare. Because many people out there, like myself, Diane, other ones, were unemployed. We've been trying to get work. There's a regulation that basically says when you sign for a welfare check, you've actually signed away your rights under Employment Standards Act. And they can force you into whatever low-wage job. They don't even have to pay you. They can keep you on a welfare check up to a year, even though you're working. And that's the reality of it. But people don't know that. They really don't understand what that is. And there's also, like, this whole kind of Employment Hamilton, or Employment Ontario thing, is there's no mandate to make sure that if they're placing you in employment, that your rights, that the employer is following Employment Standards Act, Occupational Health and Safety, and it's even questionable even under WSIB. So this is the reality out there. This is why I feel it's so important that all people need to start joining together and really banding together, because if we don't, it's going to be disastrous. It's going to be really bad. So, you know, I'm really thankful for all you people to come out tonight, and I hope that you can take what I'm saying home and go on with that. Thank you.
The second half of the meeting was mostly about the people that are working and their fears and what they can do or can't do as a union. Please forgive all the background noise. Everybody gets a little bit antsy at the half-hour mark, starts fidgeting around with their papers, pens, etc., or side conversations. Tried to get most of it out, but some of it still crept into the conversation. You are listening to The Other Side of the News on 93.3 CFMU-FM.
Sort of food banks as well, that often people have to be in a particular catchment area, so you can't move around the city of Hamilton in order to get to different food banks. So you can only use those a couple times a month. You have to come with proof of ID, so anyone who doesn't have ID currently on them isn't going to get that service. And then if you, as Michelle said, you also have to go through a means test. So you might find yourself all the way there, have your ID, if you're lucky enough to have that on you, with your rent check, et cetera, and be turned away because, according to them, you have too much income.
Someone else have a comment?
Yeah.
Jim?
Well, it's just a point what you said. Under the Employment Standards Act, it's put in the regulations and around workfare. He also took away the right, like you said, under Occupational Health and Safety.
So all of us that are working, we have a right to refuse unsafe work if an employer tries to ask us to do something, right?
Yeah.
So people who are on welfare, on workfare, cannot refuse unsafe work, so they can be used as virtual guinea pigs, and that's disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
That is disgusting. Mm-hmm. You had your hand up first.
Sorry. My name is Rob Hammer. Now, what you were saying about the food banks, I and this lady down at the end here.
Megan.
Mm-hmm. Megan, is it?
Yeah.
I did a little survey myself with the food banks. I had hit three. I had shown them the proof of my ID and what I had and all. I was out of three of them. I got food from two. Where I had got my first food from, the apples were rotten and so were the oranges.
Mm-hmm.
The second one was a little better, not much. The third one, denied me because of what I made on my check. And I turned around and I told a friend of mine that worked at the newspaper that what I had done, and he turned around and he asked me which ones, and he went and he looked in on it. And it was the one on Mary and King, Mary and Cannon.
Good job.
The one on Barton Street.
St. Matthews.
And then there's another one.
Mission Services?
Yeah. Social Services, the one that you just mentioned.
Mission Services.
That was the one I got turned down by. Out of all that, when I had told my friend at the newspaper, he went and he done a piece on it. He went and looked in on it himself, and he found that when he went, he had looked in the vents, and he found nothing but rotten bread. It wasn't even fit to feed a bird.
A little twist in this.
Sure.
Very challenging person. But it makes me think. So sometimes I get that individuals that are on welfare or mother's allowance, it's as though the government wants them to stay on it. As much as they're doing an injustice and they're cutting checks and they're cutting benefits and cutting all the perks, it's as though they want you mentally to think that you can't even go for a job because what if it doesn't work, then you're going to mess up your chances with welfare. You're not going to get that check that you're guaranteed to get every month at the exact same time. Ideally, if we were in the ideal situation, it would be wonderful if we could show the government that, you know what, we don't even need you. We don't even need this thing called welfare or mother's allowance, because we are going to make it. We're going to do much better than you think that you're setting us up for, and we're going to basically be the ones to put up our hands and say that we did it. It so irritates me, because I truly believe that they have us on lock and key and they just don't want to let us go. Because what they do? Who are they going to call the cards on? Right? They want to turn it on the people that are doing good and trying to make a living, make us look like we're the bad ones, but reality is it's really them. And don't get me wrong, I'm an individual, and I said where I work, I'm not going to necessarily announce it out loud. But, you know, I feel bad hearing about it. I do. And don't think that I wasn't there one day.
Okay. I just want to get back to the issue about precarious work and workfare. But when Harris brought it in, changed it from welfare to workfare, and created this, and the term, and Michelle's good on this with the temp workers, that it's precarious work. I know, I worked at Nortel through the 90s and the 2000s. The workplace today is not what it was 20 years ago.
No.
Where there's so much temp work out there, it's ridiculous. And with Ontario Works, Workfare, they have an economic slave class that they can do whatever they want with us.
Exactly.
And capitalism works off of it. And as union workers and non-unionized workers, this is why raising the rates in Ontario Works is an issue for the unions, because this is the one that they can use against you, where you have to say that's wrong and it should not be allowed. And I think that's something that unions really have to hammer home, because even amongst dividing it, and I know when John Clark presented this, he went, united we eat, divided we starve.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll break off unionized people, so the ununionized worker and the poor people. And actually, we had a political action committee earlier this afternoon. Someone heard a comment where she was talking about workers, and someone came up to her and says, but you're not talking about the poor people. This poor person didn't felt that working included them. And again, and even on social assistance, like Michelle was saying, I'm on ODSP now, and I thank God for that I'm least stable, but the people that are on welfare, I was on it for a year, and it was hell. The changes really need to be made to that. And it's that workfare issue, which we really, even as a campaign, we haven't done a lot for. And this is where we need your help to get the government to make changes about this. So
I think we're going to just move on to the next topic. We're going to continue hearing from people and having a discussion around point number five. One of the messages that we've been trying to convey in these education sessions to kind of strengthen the link between the organizing that's happening in the community around this issue and the importance of the union being involved is that the way things are right now in terms of austerity measures and in terms of many of our fellow CUPE members, many of them now being part-time, paying benefits, not having them in many cases, particularly things, for example, those that work in the community or social services, for example. The message that we're trying to convey, and I think is something that we're also hearing from people, is that a lot of unionized workers, including CUPE members, are not that far away from actually at some point having to rely on social assistance and eventually on ODSP. So what we're trying to do is also just highlight the high level of poverty and inequity that is happening in Ontario. Right now, there is 840,000 people in Ontario that are on welfare or ODSP. 40% of those are children. And it's not only the special diet issue, the issue of food security or hunger, it's not just for people on social assistance only. There's around 375,000 people in Ontario right now that are using food banks on a monthly basis, and that's gone up about 20% in the past year. And about 30% of the people that are using food banks in Ontario are people that are employed. Actually, they're not necessarily unemployed or on assistance. They're people. 30% of the people that are using food banks in Ontario currently are employed part-time, full-time, or were recently employed in the last 6 months. So it's not just an issue for people that are quote-unquote poor or on social assistance. The issue of poverty, the issue of hunger is becoming an increasing reality for people that are employed and even for some members in the union movement. Part of the link that we've tried to do is that in the same budget, the austerity budget that McGuinty announced, the cut to the special diet program, which is $200 million, was being invested in the special diet program per year. In that same budget, McGuinty also put forth that there needed to be a wage freeze for the broader public sector. Now, when McGuinty and the Liberal Party are talking about the broader public sector, we're talking about people that work in healthcare, in education, people that work in nonprofit social and community services agencies. In total, the broader public sector in Ontario is about 1 million workers. 60% of those workers are women. And so the message that we're trying to drive or convey, especially with CUPE members and other union activists that come to our sessions, is that, again, the cuts to social assistance rates are part of the package that is proposing a wage freeze. And actually, a wage freeze has been proposed for unionized broader public sector workers. Our unions, including CUPE, sat at the table with McGuinty's people, who did not agree to the wage freeze. But the McGuinty government did legislate a wage freeze for about 350,000 workers in Ontario, managers that work in the broader public sector and non-unionized workers. And again, 60% of those are women. So there has been a wage freeze that has been implemented. So that's kind of the link that we think needs to be made in terms of how these austerity measures, these cuts, are impacting broad sectors of the community, both employed, unemployed, people on assistance, and also people that are unionized. The other element or the other component of this austerity budget that was implemented in March of last year is a $2.6 billion corporate tax cut that Lisa mentioned. So, you can't afford $200 million for a special diet program for people that are on social assistance. But then, you can implement a 3.6 or 3.7 corporate tax cut for the 3 years. So I think we have to start making those connections, because there is money, but it's not for people that are poor or not for the wages of workers, unionized or non-unionized, in the broader public sector or in the private sector. But there is government subsidies, in a sense, for corporations. So that's kind of part of the link that we think is important to make around solidarity and the link between unions, CUPE, and people on social assistance and people that are poor.
I attended the women's conference in January of this year, and you didn't touch on it, so in case you don't, I wanted to be able to bring it up. Is they were saying women who were on, who got pensions, they were saying the percentage, how much less they earn, so how much less their pension is, so how they are struggling as well. I know we haven't really touched on it, but I want to bring that up because it was alarming. Because as women, we generally earn less, so their pensions are relatively less, and then it's alarming. So it's not just, you know, the poor. It hits all groups, women, but I just want to make sure.
Yeah, even if they have a pension. You
know, yeah.
If they have one.
Yeah.
If they have one at all.
Lisa?
Yeah, I think also related to that too, this year they announced, or recently they announced that there's going to be a freeze on the minimum wage, right? So they're not going to account for inflation on the minimum wage this year. Which you can see who they're going after, right? Like they're affecting people's pensions, they're low-income people, working poor, women, people of color, right? That's who's being most affected in this economic crisis and who's being forced really to pay for the economic crisis that we didn't create, right? Mm-hmm. Wasn't us who own these banks and, you know, bailed out these banks that were failing, but we're being forced to pay for their crisis. And I think it's important also to note that right now in Ontario, 1 in 6 workers are working at or close to minimum wage. So 1 in 6 workers are working at or close to minimum wage, and now that minimum wage is being frozen. And related to that, the gap between minimum wage and welfare is greater now than it ever has been in history. So you see that people, as Michelle's already said, poor people on assistance or poor people struggling in temp jobs, from job to job, are being forced into the worst and worst paid and quite frankly the most dangerous jobs on offer. And that whole economy is being created right there. And that, you know, for all of us, is a downward pressure on all of our wages and really takes this social safety net right out from underneath of us.
Also, maybe especially for the QP members here, if any of you want to mention how this austerity is impacting your particular workplaces or sectors, if you want to, you know. I mean, I work in a drop-in center in downtown Toronto, social services, community services, and, you know, we're bargaining right now, so we haven't been legislated, a wage freeze, but the message that McGuinty sent on the budget. Plus, he also said, I think it's agencies like these agencies, they get more than $1 million from the province. If they implement some type of wage increase, the government, you know, whether it's legislated or not, they're not going to give funding for any increases. Now, it's not just for wages. You can't improve benefits, pensions, so it's a comprehensive compensation increase. So even though it hasn't been legislated for our particular workplace, you can imagine the chill at the bargaining table when on the other side the employer says, well, you know, like, you know we can't give you those increases that you're proposing. I mean, you know, we're not going to get the money from the government. So it's a very difficult, we're bargaining in a very difficult, restrained environment. Jim?
Probably the worst environment I've seen, and I've been active for about 25 years, but Ontario has been far more ruthless in their policy than other provinces have. I mean, in the East, unions have managed to find ways of getting the increases, and the same thing out West, but like you said, I mean, it's very comprehensive. For example, in a lot of our collective agreements and developmental services, we have provisions for, say, Ontario dental rates, say that employer agrees to pay the 2011 rates. Well, under this freeze period, any increase in that would be viewed as compensation, right? So the longer it's imposed, the further for a long time. It's really in our interest to get behind campaigns like this.
Anybody else?
Well, it's a hospital worker. I mean, the hospital, we don't have the right to strike. We bargained with our hospital, which is the Hamilton House Sciences, think bigger is better, so they opted out of the central bargaining. So we, as over 3,000 QB members, haven't had a raise for a year and a half. And it looks like what we even did our last contract. Plus, every time we turn around, they're starting to contract work out. So now all the outside areas of the hospital that are being cleaned are being cleaned under Sodexo. The Sodexo is the company and the union is the union. And so they're paid barely, just above minimum wage. They're not trained properly. So you wake up and you'll hear all of the things that are going on in the hospital with infections and having to close hospital wards down and not letting people in because there's infection. It's because they're not being cleaned properly. Just people aren't being trained that are working there. And it's not their fault. Right? So, but that's so it's coming from us on both sides, both workplace and with and
We are in collective bargaining. So it's a provincial discussion table.
Say that again, sorry.
We're in bargaining with the provincial discussion table.
What's that?
It's OSBCC, which is the Ontario School Board. So we're all the school boards together have the option to go to this discussion table and negotiate certain things. One of them is pay increase, the other is benefits, and the list goes on and on. We went on strike in 2006 for only 6 days, but we had quite a number of our brothers and sisters who had to go to the food bank. As a result, after the strike was over, we did fundraising for the food bank. But the fact that these people are full-time employed, but like you said, they go from paycheck to paycheck. And that's very sad. In a province that's as rich as we are.
You've been waiting for a while.
I like what you said, Michelle. I thought it was really good. We have to stick together. We can't let the government divide us and alienate us, you know, because we're the only ones that are fighting for these people. We have to stay together. And the thing that I would like to see, I talked to you about this, Michelle, is to use the very laws that the government has made up against these people. You know, Michelle, we discussed this, so to research it and just to...
When Lisa was talking about minimum wage, a lot of people think that if you get a minimum wage job, you can support yourself. In anti-poverty and in poverty elimination, there's a living wage. Is that because in another group is the working poor, and she talked about it, where you can get a full-time job, work your 2,000 hours, but if you're working for minimum wage, you can't support your family. I don't know the figures. I think Michelle was saying earlier, living wage is somewhere closer to $13 an hour.
$13
an hour, I think. Yeah. And one of the things we're trying to do in Hamilton is we've lobbied City Council, where City Hall, and I've gone to a lot of City Hall meetings, they said they want to be a living wage community. Yeah, I've gone to a bunch in the city, you know, like the federal review of the budget, the provincial, so is the city. And I've heard the biggest pressures, 4.7% increase in municipal wages, and yet they want a 0% tax increase. And they're putting those pressures down, and it's, how can they do the one but not the other?
You can't fix anything. You cannot make any steps to change how we live with our society and culture until you know what the problems are and where the problems are stemming from.
But I just wish it could be simple.
All people need to start joining together and really banding together, because if we don't, it's going to be disastrous. It's going to be really bad.
A lot of these government people and policies, they get this education and they think that they're so much more intelligent and so much more smarter and they should be in charge. Well, they've been in charge for quite a while. They're not doing a good job, and I don't care what kind of policies they say they got with the environment. It sucks, because it's getting worse. It isn't getting better. And if we don't stand up together and start fighting for the livelihood of our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren, everyone can see where this earth is going. Everyone can see that the money and the business millionaire guys are getting richer, and the people are getting sicker. Plants and animals and all these things that are dying in our lifetime. And
who is stopping it? How do we stop that?
Redefining Radio.
Radio.